It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, Chicago saw a big jump in homicides last year, driven mostly by fatal shootings. Our guest shares some of the latest data and efforts to turn the tide.
First, Michigan billionaire and charter school advocate Betsy DeVos was confirmed as the next Secretary of Education this morning. Her confirmation came after long and sometimes contentious hearings with senators.
Her confirmation in the Senate today wasn't smooth sailing, with a 50-50 split among senators.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative and the nomination is confirmed.
That's Vice President Mike Pence casting a historic deciding vote to confirm DeVos. But what could her appointment mean for schools throughout the country? And what could her advocacy for voucher schools hurt public schools moving forward?
Caitlin Emma joins us now to talk about this news. She's a reporter for Politico and covers education, politics, and national trends. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we heard, Vice President Mike Pence casting the tie-breaking vote, first time a vice president's vote was needed to confirm a cabinet secretary. Any surprises with what went down on Betsy DeVos's confirmation this morning?
I don't think anything was a surprise. I mean, everybody expected her to, you know, sort of head to the floor with a 50-50 standoff, and then Vice President Mike Pence was going to come in and have to be the deciding vote as the tiebreaker, which, like you just said, is unprecedented. You know, I think everybody last week was watching closely after Republicans Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins came out and said that they weren't going to vote for her, and it set off a little bit of panic in terms of, you know, there's only one more Republican is needed to, you know, overturn one of Donald Trump's nominees, and it sort of set off a furious effort over the weekend to find that one person. But, you know, ultimately those efforts weren't successful.
Well, let's break down some of those arguments on both sides here. What were the arguments in favor of confirming DeVos? What were Republicans saying in support of her?
So over the last 24 hours, we've seen the Senate come to the Senate floor and debate Betsy DeVos for literally 24 hours. And far more Democrats spoke out against her than Republicans did in favor for her. But what we did hear from Republicans like John Cornyn or Mitch McConnell was that, you know, Democrats have tried to stonewall Trump's nominees at every turn. And, you know, one of Betsy DeVos's strengths is that she is an outsider to, you know, education. She's not a quote-unquote education bureaucrat, is what John Cornyn said. You know, she brings something new to the table, brings a different experience to the table. You know, and essentially their argument is that education decision-making power will be returned to states and school districts after, you know, 8 years of the Obama administration where they had a more heavy hand when it came to enforcement and oversight. So restoring local control is sort of the catchphrase of the day when it comes to talking about Betsy DeVos.
And in that 24-hour marathon floor session, Democrats voiced their opposition yesterday through the night. And here's Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. Let's take a listen.
I have heard from thousands of parents and teachers and other citizens of Wisconsin who are concerned about the future of our educational system and urging me to oppose Mrs. DeVos and certainly opposing her vision for America's students. As of today, over 20,000 Wisconsinites have emailed me. We've had over 7,000 phone calls opposing the confirmation of Mrs. DeVos.
Well, Caitlin, what could this groundswell of opposition signal for DeVos moving forward?
Right. Well, it's something that we're definitely exploring now, you know, whether all of this opposition and animosity toward her will, you know, cause her to be a weakened education secretary. You know, at the same time, it's also possible that she has enough Republican support in Congress and a Republican presidential administration to accomplish her priorities, even though there is widespread Democratic opposition to her. Already we've seen Democrats sort of draw a line in the sand over this confirmation. We have a story up now that says the president of the National Education Association, which is the nation's largest teachers union, saying, you know, there will be no relationship with Betsy DeVos. So there are really no good feelings here from the Democratic side. You know, a lot of folks have told us that Betsy DeVos will have a lot of outreach to do when it comes to, you know, her opponents. But whether really it affects her ability to get anything done remains to be seen.
We're talking with Caitlin Emma. She covers education, politics, and national trends for Politico. Caitlin, at the same time this was going on, there was House Republican Thomas Massie of Kentucky who introduced a bill to dissolve the Department of Education by the end of 2018 and give control back to the states and the local level. It's the very department DeVos will lead. What could this mean?
Right. I did. That bill was introduced today. It's sort of a familiar Republican talking point, conservative talking point that we've heard, you know, at least throughout the presidential race. I think the Trump administration picking Betsy DeVos as an education secretary signals that they're serious about keeping the agency around. Although I've reported that, you know, DeVos's folks are considering restructuring the education department amid calls to shrink it, since they won't be getting rid of it. So I suspect that the education department won't be going away, but it might be getting smaller.
DeVos was criticized for being just woefully ill-prepared for the questions she faced during confirmation. Can she recover from the backlash and the memes and the Saturday Night Live skits? Will this education secretary be given a chance?
Certainly. The confirmation hearing was bumpy, and it sort of took off on social media in a way that, you know, unlike we've ever seen before, where, you know, friends and people who typically aren't politically active were talking about Betsy DeVos and grizzly bears and all of that. So it will be hard to bounce back from, you know, in terms of getting everybody to work together. So it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward and how she intends to reach out to the communities who felt hurt by her confirmation performance. You know, for example, special education groups were alarmed that she seemed unfamiliar with sort of a bedrock civil rights special education law. And, you know, she'll definitely have to do some outreach on her part in order to get everybody in the same boat.
And senators had requested that Betsy DeVos release details of her financial ties. Are there still ethics concerns that are up in the air?
Democrats like Senator Patty Murray, who's a ranking Democrat on the HELP committee, they still have concerns about her finances. You know, for example, Elizabeth Warren the other day was sort of railing on Betsy DeVos because, you know, she has yet to disclose some information about the family trust that she will remain involved in. You know, her finances and ethics paperwork was substantial and very long, and it took, you know, government ethics bodies a long time to parse through it. And, you know, Democrats say they're still not satisfied with some of those answers, but it remains to be seen whether or not they'll get those answers.
Do we have any idea the issues she might tackle first?
I think what we're likely to see is, you know, some sort of doubling down on the school choice, on school choice support. And by school choice, I mean the expansion of charter schools, which are sometimes publicly funded but privately run, or school vouchers, which often provide low-income students with public funding to attend private school. You know, we could see that in the budget that is proposed for the education department or somewhere else. She has a lot of work to do in the Every Student Succeeds Act, the new education law that passed in 2015. States are working quickly to develop those plans under that new law, and they're going to need clarity on how to move forward. It's a little unclear where she stands on areas like higher ed or pre-K, because she's predominantly sort of only operated in this school choice space. And I think a lot of people are going to hope that she makes some sort of good faith outreach to, you know, public education advocates who feel like she hasn't committed herself to public education or that she has no experience in that space. So I think a lot of folks will be looking for that as sort of an olive branch.
And will she continue to be under the microscope? Because their constituents were calling their senators and tying up phone lines on the switchboard, and just that groundswell of opposition. Will people continue to watch her?
Right. I think that she'll be watched very closely. It's become very clear that Democrats, like I said earlier, have drawn a line in the sand with this one. Education is an emotional issue that, touches the lives of every single person. I was telling someone earlier, I might not know what's going on with the Treasury Department, but, I went to public school. So it's certainly an emotional issue for everyone, and everyone has a stake. We have a story up right now on Politico talking about how Betsy DeVos's opponents are going to make her job really difficult for her moving forward, and I don't think that they intend to give up. So I think she definitely will be under a microscope.
Going back to the two Republican senators who broke rank, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, they announced last week that they would vote against DeVos. Wondering, why do you think more Republicans didn't cross the aisle on this one?
I think party pressure on this is intense. In terms of what Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins did, some congressional sort of analysts out there think that they were able to speak out because Mitch McConnell was so confident that in the whip count, essentially, that they had enough votes to confirm Betsy DeVos with Vice President Pence being the tiebreaker, that Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins were essentially allowed to go out and do that without really many consequences for them. They're both coming from states in Maine and Alaska where, the notion of school choice isn't as popular as it might be in some other red states. So it's certainly, the party pressure on this has been intense, and it's been a very politicized process for all of President Donald Trump's nominees.
Caitlin, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Emma is a reporter for Politico, where she covers education, politics, and national trends. She joined us today to talk about the Senate confirmation of Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, with Vice President Mike Pence casting the tie-breaking vote.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up later, a guest looks into the science of popularity and why some hits rise to the top while others flop.
First, Chicago's homicide rates surged last year, along with increases in many of the nation's other big cities after a decades-long decline in homicides nationwide since peaks in the 1980s and 90s.
Chicago, in particular, was in the national spotlight as President Trump made a statement via Twitter saying, quote, "If Chicago doesn't fix the horrible carnage going on," he wrote, "I will send in the feds." Well, the FBI, ATF, DEA, and U.S. Marshals are already working with police in Chicago on gun violence issues. The first month of 2017 saw continued high homicide rates after a big jump in 2016.
Our next guest has been reporting on violence in Chicago, the role of guns, community efforts to turn the tide, and the police response. Ann Givens is a law enforcement reporter for The Trace. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In data you reported on from the University of Chicago Crime Lab, it looks like the jump in Chicago's homicide rate is specifically an increase in fatal shootings. What kind of information did you see there?
So the University of Chicago Crime Lab did a comprehensive study about the change in crime rate in Chicago last year. And what they found was a huge increase in all kinds of gun-related crimes. The biggest jump was in homicide, and those numbers climbed a huge 58%. 764 people were killed in Chicago last year, and most of those were by guns. 91% were firearm deaths. And then the next biggest increase was in non-fatal shootings, which were up 43%. Almost 3,000 people were shot and survived in Chicago last year.
And non-gun crimes, did we see any similar change in those, or is this a story about an increase in gun crime in general?
I think that if you take gun crime out of the equation, one thing that was of some interest to us was that without gun crimes, Chicago crime from 2015 to 2016 actually stayed pretty steady. So when we're talking about the story of the increase in violence in Chicago, we really are talking about a story of gun violence.
How does Chicago compare with some of the nation's other big cities when it comes to homicide rates in general and gun homicide in particular?
It's an interesting question because I think we hear so much about Chicago and probably more than we do about any other city these days. And I think the big reason for that is that Chicago is such a big city. So really more people were killed in Chicago last year than in any other city. But if you look at per capita rates, Chicago is actually number 8 on among U.S. cities of people who are killed in homicides. And cities that had more homicides than Chicago include St. Louis, Baltimore, Detroit, New Orleans. But we hear a lot about Chicago, I think, just because the numbers took such a steep climb last year, and also just because it's one of our biggest cities.
Now, we hear about an increase in gun deaths, in homicides in the United States, a lot of that focused in particular cities. Is it also focused in within those cities? Is it something that's a citywide phenomenon, or are police seeing it really keyed into particular areas?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, no, I mean, in Chicago in particular, the it really is keyed into particular neighborhoods in Chicago, and I think police now are looking at some of the reasons why that is. But there are really just a few of the police districts in Chicago that account for a really large percentage of the homicides and the gun crimes there.
One thing that was striking in your write-up on this research, it's not just an increase in gun crime. The kinds of guns involved, the calibers of guns involved, are changing. What do we see?
So this is not just a Chicago issue. It's something that's happening nationwide, that The Trace, which is the nonprofit news organization that I work for, has done some real reporting on. But the Chicago Crime Lab found that there were more, in 2016, high-caliber guns were used more often than they had been at any point in the last 15 years. So that's like 9mm and 40-caliber firearms. And that is a trend that is taking place nationwide. Police are recovering more high-caliber firearms at crime scenes. And when we've spoken to medical experts, they say that that is going to come with a correlation to fatal crimes because these high-caliber guns are more likely to kill.
Talking to Ann Givens, law enforcement reporter for The Trace. Ann, we've laid out the problem here, pretty striking. You've also looked into some efforts to solve it. You've looked at, talked to some of the police technology people in Chicago, how they're trying to use a shot spotter technology, which we have in Milwaukee and some other places around the state, particularly Milwaukee, though. What are they working on in Chicago to try to react faster to shootings?
Yeah, so as you said, this is technology that's being used in many cities around the country, and Chicago has used it a bit in the past in very, very, I think it's 3 square miles they've been using it in the past, but now they've expanded it to be in place throughout their 2 most dangerous police districts. And so what this is it's gunshot sensors that immediately detect and alert police when a gun is fired. And what that what police say that's going to allow them to do is know with a really high degree of accuracy and also very quickly when a gun is fired so that they can respond. Because not always does somebody call 911. Somebody calls 911 and they say, yeah, I heard a gunshot, but I'm not sure exactly where. So this will allow police to respond. And that's, police say, good for a number of reasons. One, the bad guys and the neighborhood gets used to the idea that police are always going to come. So if I shoot my gun, the police are going to be here. So maybe that's a deterrent to shooting a gun. And the other reason is this new technology that's being used more and more, where police are collecting bullet casings. And bullet casings, as you may know, have are left with an imprint that is distinct to the gun that shot it, almost like a fingerprint. So if you get a bullet casing in one neighborhood, it might, if you examine it, it might tell you that it was shot from the same gun as a bullet casing that you had in another neighborhood. And police are hoping that by collecting all the bullets, because now they're going to be able to know exactly where the shots were fired, they will be able to create a database that will allow them to solve cold cases, solve new cases, and, you know, and obviously if more people are being arrested, then probably that's a deterrent to people committing the crimes in the first place.
And Anne, you also looked at a community effort to reduce gun violence, Violence Interrupters. We've talked to the founder of that effort here on the show. People saw a lot of promise on it, but you went out and found that funding for it has been cut way back. There are way fewer people doing this kind of work over the last couple of years.
That's exactly right. It's a really interesting organization. So it is basically, it's called Cure Violence. It exists in 25 cities around the nation, and it was started in Chicago. And the idea of it is that the people who, that violence spreads the same way that a disease would spread, and that the way to stop it is to find the people who are infected, which is the people who are the victims and the perpetrators of the violence, and stop them from spreading it. And they use people who are very familiar with these communities, so not just of the neighborhoods, but in many cases former criminals, former gang leaders, who have a credibility in that community that allows them to speak to the people who are perpetrating the violence and convince them to stop. At one point there were over 100 violence interrupters working in Chicago. State funding cuts have really just decimated them, and now there are only about 8 outreach workers working in the city. And the violence interrupters, the Cure Violence, has maintained that they're very effective when they are in place and when they're fully funded, and at a time when Chicago is in such dire need of solutions, they really should be funded better.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Anne Givens from The Trace. We have a link to her work on gun violence in Chicago on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, in a world of endless entertainment options, we look at what makes something stand out. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, African-American women and Latinas are getting lower quality cervical cancer treatment than white women, according to new research. We find out why and what can be done.
First, what makes something popular? In today's world, where we're surrounded by a pretty much infinite amount of products, ideas, services, songs, entertainment options, why do some things rise to the top and become cultural phenomena and others just remain in obscurity?
Our next guest wanted to answer these questions, and while it seems like it's all luck, it turns out that's not the case. From memes to music videos, there's a lot going on behind the scenes designed to grab our attention and influence our behavior, and as humans, we tend to go for it time and time again.
Derek Thompson joins us now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics and the media. He's the author of the new book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So as we said, your book is trying to tackle this big question of what makes a thing popular. And you're talking movies, products, pop culture, songs. And you call this a science. Why?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, I think pop culture is sort of inherently sentimental. People feel really emotionally about their favorite songs and their favorite movies and television shows. And, I write about economics at The Atlantic, and economics is a really unsentimental industry. It's numbers. It's a science. It's about figuring out, what's actually happening and not caring about people's emotions necessarily. And so what I tried to set out to do with this book is essentially to write an unsentimental book book about the most sentimental subject there is. And what was really fun for me was, you know, I of course wanted to talk to, you know, people who made movies and people at music labels and people whose ideas have gone viral on the internet or whose books and ideas have gone viral. But I also wanted to talk to the academics, people who are holed up in ivory towers thinking about this stuff and never talking to the movie studios and music labels. And it turned out that they actually had a surprising amount of overlap. Both of them, I think, have realized that even though people want to like new things, we want to tell ourselves we love originality, we actually just like familiarity. We love what we know. And so across the pop culture landscape, you see that some of the biggest hits are often sort of interesting tweaks on the familiar, familiar surprises, essentially.
Yeah, and that's a big tension all through your book, the love of the new and the fear of the new and figuring out how to hit that sweet spot where it's familiar enough to me, but not so familiar that it's boring, and new to me, but not so new that it's outside of my framework. That's the big struggle, it seems like, for a lot of creators.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think you put it perfectly. I think that another way to say it is that people are both neophilic. They love new things. They seek out new things. They want to discover new fashions and ideas. At the same time, they're neophobic. They're afraid of new things. They don't like anything that's too new. If they confront an idea that's too new, they'll just assume that it's wrong. If they hear a piece of music that has nothing to do with the taste they've established, they'll just assume that it's bad. And so I think that it's really interesting to think about trying to marry these two ideas. And, you know, one really interesting example, I think, is Spotify and Discover Weekly. Discover Weekly is Spotify's dump of 30 songs every Monday. Initially, the app was supposed to be 30 entirely new songs from bands that users had never heard of. And they were doing some internal testing and accidentally let slip some bands and songs that users had actually heard before. It was accidentally too familiar. And so they fixed the bug, and they kept testing it, and engagement with the app after they fixed this bug collapsed. So essentially, just having a little bit of familiarity in this new product, which was essentially a discovery product, made it much, much more popular.
Yeah, and we often hear the cliche of the movie pitch or, you know, oh, it's like Beaches meets Total Recall or something like that.
Right.
It's two familiar things put together in a slightly different way, and that's all it takes a lot of times, as creative as we think we are and as discerning as we think we are, just that little twist. We're actually kind of predictable when they put these things together.
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is now we're not just talking about psychology. We're really talking about marketing, right? Like you have an incredibly new idea, no one really knows what to do with it. And then you say, oh, well, I'll just give it a high concept pitch, right? Like Airbnb, for example, was struggling to communicate to some people exactly what they were doing. And some people out in Y Combinator in San Francisco said, well, just tell them you're eBay for space. And then suddenly, right, consumers understood, oh, okay, eBay for space. Got it. You know, when Uber was getting off the ground and Lyft, no one knew what to think of them. And so they were thought of essentially as eBay for cars or Airbnb for cars, right? And now we think of new companies as being Uber for X and Lyft for Y. And so we need, in order to understand a new concept or a new product, a little bit of a hold in something that's already familiar.
Talking to Derek Thompson, his new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. So, Derek, here's a familiar maybe movie plot. The genius artist or musician or whatever struggles in obscurity, but they're just so good that inevitably their brilliant stuff comes out and becomes, in one way or another, a hit. That's not really the way it works, is it?
No, yeah, and again, this is one of those sentimental myths that doesn't quite pan out when you talk to the academics. I think that both producers and consumers of culture want to believe that quality is destiny. The producers want to believe that quality is destiny because they want to say, look, if I've written a great book, if I've written a great article or made a great movie, my work is done. I don't have to worry about distribution. The work is self-distributing because of its inherent genius. So believing that quality is destiny in a weird way allows them to be a little bit lazy on the back end. Consumers want to believe the same thing, though, right? We want to think that that there are reasons why our favorite movies and songs are our favorites, that they are in some way the best at doing something that they do. But again and again throughout pop culture history, you see that throughout pop culture history, you essentially see that distribution matters much more for success than the quality of the content itself. You see this with, like, the Impressionist canon in the first chapter of the book, where you had a bunch of Impressionists who were all sort of equally hated at the time, and then only a handful of them actually hung at the Musée de Luxembourg in the 1890s. And the seven who hung in the Musée de Luxembourg for the first time in the 1890s are still the seven that we consider the best painters. Is it because they were the best? It's hard to say. They are there in the canon now because of the distribution provided by that first French museum.
But we think that things are different now with this idea that things can go viral. All I need to do is spread a thing to some people. They're going to spread it to some other people, and it's just going to just sort of on its own spread out there. You don't completely buy that.
No, I do think, right. So in the book, I talk about the so-called viral myth, this idea that we think that everything that becomes popular is literally going viral. And viral has a very specific definition in epidemiology. Virality means that one person gets sick, Jeff gets sick, and Jeff spreads the disease to two people, and then those two people get sick, and you have many, many, many generations of one to two shares, right? Now, how does stuff go big online? Well, for a long time, people just didn't really know how trends spread. You couldn't literally track exactly how, say, the skinny jean got popular. But online, information always leaves a pixel trail. It leaves a data trail. You can follow the information cascades of tweets and Facebook posts. And if you look at these information cascades, they actually don't look like viruses at all. They look much more like broadcasts. Almost everything that goes big online almost always has one broadcast or 1 to 1,000, 1 to 1 million moment. So again, the viral myth is really sentimental and beautiful. It says that great products, great art is self-distributing. It's just inherently catchy and people just pass it along. But it's just not the case. Distribution, in fact, is significantly more important than content and quality in manufacturing popularity.
So if I'm trying to produce the next hit song or hit movie or whatever, what am I doing in this day and age to try to capture that fake viral nature that actually is broadcast one way or another and is going to catch on?
Right. And right. This is a great question, right? If nothing is self-distributing and popularity on the internet or popularity in markets is dictated by the biggest broadcast, then what do you do? A part of what you do, frankly, is if you are writing a book, then you go on Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about it. You understand
that's the key.
That's the key, right? Exactly. It's all about you guys. But no, you want to essentially understand that the key is hitting as many broadcast moments as possible, giving yourself as many chances as possible to have those 1 to 1 million moments, rather than essentially saying, look, I've made something that's wonderful. I'm just going to let it catch on in the market. There are lots of like little strategies that are sort of industry specific for essentially saying, you know, if you make a product that if you make a product that's going to be beloved by Seinfeld fanatics, then you know, scour the internet, look around. Where are Seinfeld fanatics gathering? Are there podcasts that reach thousands of them every single week? Are there blogs where you know episodes are being recapped over and over again? Where are essentially the focal points where this community, these cults, are sort of gathering around? And then hit those, trigger them. But don't just assume that because Seinfeld's very popular and you write something that's totally delightful about Seinfeld, it's just going to spread like wildfire.
We're talking with Atlantic Magazine editor Derek Thompson about the science of popularity. He says the mega hit movies, songs, and products that skyrocket to success after seemingly coming out of nowhere often have a secret history behind the scenes that explain their success.
You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. What was an example of a popular cultural phenomenon that took you by surprise? How did you try to explain it? And what questions do you have about the science of popularity in the digital age? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation and hear a little bit about Luck and the first big rock and roll hit coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the science of popularity and why some things hit it big, why some don't, and why we may be more predictable than we'd like to think. Our guest is Derek Thompson, author of the new book, Hitmakers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes something popular? Are you more likely to check something out if it's recommended to you by friends, colleagues, some social network of some sort? How do you discover new movies, songs, TV shows, books. If you've disliked something very popular, why? What was behind that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Derek, Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley and the Comets, first big rock and roll hit. It's one of the many stories you tell in the book. Can you tell us how it went from being an obscure kind of failed B-side to a big hit?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. This I think might be my favorite story from the book. And this gets right to the idea that we were last talking about, the idea of quality and destiny. So in 1954, Bill Haley has this song that he really wants to record, and not a lot of labels want to let him, Rock Around the Clock. They finally put it to wax and make it the B-side of this other song that's about a hydrogen bomb blowing up, a really wacky song.
Good stuff.
It comes out in 1954, and it's basically a dud. The music label tries to push it out. It gets advertisement in Billboard and Variety, but basically no one really wants to listen to it. So Rock Around the Clock is essentially a failure. The next year, a 10-year-old boy named Peter Ford, who lives in Los Angeles, is one of the several thousand people who buy the Rock Around the Clock album. Peter Ford's dad is Glenn Ford, who is a movie star, who's starring in a movie called Blackboard Jungle, which is sort of like Rebel Without a Cause, a juvenile delinquency film. The director of the film comes over to their house in L.A., and he says, I need a song to kick off this movie about, you know, rambunctious teens. And this 10-year-old boy, Peter Ford, gives the director of the movie a couple of vinyl records, including Rock Around the Clock. The song ends up going into the movie at the beginning of the movie, in the middle, and then at the end. And it's only then, 2 weeks after Blackboard Jungle comes out, that the song becomes the number one song in the country, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard, and the second best-selling song in the history of music. So if you're the sort of person that thinks that the qualities of certain cultural products explain their success, how the heck do you explain Rock Around the Clock? The song sounded the exact same in 1954 and 1955. Like, 9 months elapsed between it being a failure and it being the biggest success in the 1950s and one of the biggest successes in rock and roll history. So you can only explain the difference in these outcomes by pointing to two factors. First, distribution. It came out in a slightly new way in 1955. And second, luck. There are just some products that hit at the right moment, the right time, in the right medium for the right people, and they just basically get lucky. And that's not inspiring to a lot of people. But the antidote to, you know, a world that's probabilistic is volume. If everything that you do has a 10% chance, 15% chance of success, then what you want is to give yourself as many at-bats as possible, right? To give yourself as many Rock Around the Clock opportunities as you can.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Zach is on the line in Green Bay. Zach, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A little bit of background. I work for a popular rock station here in Green Bay as an on-air radio host. And it seems to be that every time I encounter a new song that we play, it reaches a certain peak of popularity, a certain pinnacle, and it starts to lose its soul. It starts to, you know, get a little commercialized. It's, in my opinion, it, you know, it starts to be bad. I want to know why that is. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Zach, I want to ask you, do you think it's just you've heard it so darn many times by then, or is it something about the fact that it is popular now?
I think it's something about the fact that it is popular. I think that once people get, you know, so far into the song or start, you know, a certain number of people start liking or listening to and talking about the song, that they, you know, the bands, they try to recreate that. They try to recreate that popularity in order to sell more products. And, you know, I want to know, well, you know, how did that formula come about? Why is that the way the world is?
Zach, thanks a lot. Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a great point, and I think everyone can empathize with the experience. If you imagine, you know, the first time you hear a new song, even by your favorite band in the world, it's not immediately your favorite song. You like it, and then you listen to it again, and you like it a little bit more, and again, and you like it a little bit more. You're beginning to understand how to anticipate its choruses and its grooves, but then it reaches this peak, and then it falls down the other side, so that the graph of your liking the song over time sort of resembles an upside down U or a bit of a hill. You like it, and then it reaches its sort of shock point. this happens to, with all sorts of ideas. I mean, it happens with buzzwords. It happens with tropes on television, where for the beginning of the century, the dark male antihero absolutely dominated sort of prestige television, and then people sort of realized that there was a glut of them, and so it became a little bit old hat. I think this is as psychologists sometimes call it habituation. You habituate to a certain idea or trope, which means that you get a little bit sick of it, even though familiarity overall seems to increase liking. But the second thing that's really interesting about the comment is about the idea that popularity sends a signal that is separate from the product itself. So to unpack that a little bit, I think there are some people that like Taylor Swift because she's popular, and other people that interpret Taylor Swift's popularity, just that her popularity itself, as a signal that she might be dreck or fake, and they're looking for excuses to dislike her. In sociology, this is called popularity as a taste. It means that some people are attracted to things that are popular because they're popular, and other people dislike popular things also because they're popular. And so one thing that happens with songs is that once they hit number one for a month, 2 months, 6 months, inevitably the song will wear out people, and they will associate its popularity with a bit of habituation.
Zach, thanks for that call. We're talking to Derek Thompson about his new book, Hitmakers. Derek, things are different than they were in the time of Rock Around the Clock or the Beatles. You know, back there was a time when you could say everybody's listening to this or watching this, and that wasn't true then, but a big proportion of the public was listening to or watching a particular thing because there weren't that many options. Now we've got a lot to choose from. How has that changed a popularity when we can go to a place and get exactly the kind of thing that appeals to us whenever we want?
Yep, this is a great question. So, I mean, you know, the number of books that have been published worldwide has grown by 7x since 1980. The number of movies made in the United States has grown by 7x since 1980. And the number of scripted television shows on cable networks has grown by about 7 to 8x since 1980. So what you're looking at is just a complete explosion in the sheer amount of content, the potential for, you know, leisure time and culture. So what does this do? You know, over this time, the number of hours in a day didn't grow by 7x. The day's still 24 hours long. So by definition, lots of this stuff is failing. As more and more content enters the market, even if it's a global market, you're going to have a lot more failures. Hollywood, in particular, has responded to the age of abundance, if you allow me to call it that, by essentially saying, look, people don't want to see new movies that are risky, that might be bad. If they're only going to buy 4 or 5 movie tickets a year, as they do in 2006, 2017, then we have to anticipate that they're only going to buy tickets to movies with characters and plots that they recognize. And as a result, the entire business model of Hollywood has reoriented around franchises, around sequels and adaptations and comic book universes. In 1996, none of the top 10 movies were sequels. This year, 6 of the top 10 were sequels, and I think the only exceptions were animated films. So you have seen an incredibly dramatic shift in the economic model of Hollywood that is a direct response to the age of abundance that you talked about.
Derek, as we wrap up, has looking at how hits are made changed the way you look at the things that you stumble across and listen to and maybe second-guess yourself as to why you're latching onto this trend or song or whatever?
Yeah, two things. First, one of the clear takeaways from my research into the book and hopefully from people reading the book is that familiarity is just an unbelievably powerful drug. And it's not just powerful in music and movies where we want to hear familiar chord structures and see familiar storylines. It's also a really powerful drug in politics. I think for many people, it's pretty clear through the sociological research that whether you're looking at misogyny or racism or the potential to embrace multiculturalism, often what you're looking at is a bias toward the familiar. People who are not familiar with minorities tend to be very skeptical of them. People who grow up in multicultural areas tend to be much more embracing. So what you're looking at overall is just, you know, the incredible seductiveness of familiarity across both culture and politics. And I think that, you know, it behooves people to take a line from, I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said, I don't like that man, I ought to get to know him better.
And that's a great place to leave it. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He writes there about economics and the media. He's the author of the new book we've been talking about, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. You can read a little more about that book and share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Some sad news to report from an inspiring life. The longest living aquarium fish in the world passed away this week just on the road at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago.
Granddad, the Australian lungfish, was estimated to be in his 90s. The exact age isn't clear. He came to Chicago in 1933 for the World's Fair. He was believed to be in his teens by the time he arrived.
Shedd Aquarium estimated that over 104 million people had seen Granddad since he joined the team over 80 years ago.
Among those people, me, Rob Ferret. I have seen Granddad and the other lungfish there, and I find lungfish really fascinating. This is going to sound really basic. It's because they're fish, but they have lungs.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, that's not a common thing for a fish, in my limited understanding.
No, and he, Granddad, made us curious about what lungfish are and made us do a little Google search. Hopefully, Granddad, dare I say it, didn't get flushed down a big giant toilet.
I don't think so, no. I think they handle that with a little more dignity. So Australian lungfish, unlike a lot of them, they have just one lung. They can use it to, breathe a little bit. And also, I understand they use it to, like, control their pitch and
depth,
jaw,
uh-huh,
or whatever fish do to move around. So, yeah, fascinating stuff. I'll do more Wikipedia searching on Australian lungfish as the day goes on. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.